Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, the oldest and largest collection of public radio programming in the United States, and this is From the Vault. This week, we celebrate the 50th anniversary of the American Civil Rights Movement Freedom Rides that began in May of 1961.
The Freedom Ride then proceeded from Atlanta to Birmingham, and that, as everyone knows by now, is where they ran into their most serious violence. That was at Anniston, Alabama, which is a rest stop between Atlanta, Georgia, and Birmingham. The Greyhound bus had its tires slashed by hoodlums at Anniston. Then the hoodlums were there waiting for it in their cars, and they got out and with clubs and rocks broke the windows of the bus and threw a firebomb inside, which created a great deal of smoke and then burst into flames, and the bus was completely gutted and destroyed.
The Freedom Rides was an organized effort by civil rights activists who began riding interstate buses on May 4, 1961, to test two landmark Supreme Court rulings. 1960, Boynton versus the State of Virginia, which prohibited racial segregation in restaurants and waiting rooms of bus terminals that crossed state lines. And 1955's Sarah Keyes versus Carolina Coach Company, which outlawed discrimination in interstate bus travel. If I were to tell you that Henry David Thoreau played an important role in the Freedom Rides, you might ask me to check my historical timeline. But as you will hear in this program, no one event occurs in a vacuum. So let's connect some dots. The Freedom Rides of 1961 followed on the heels of the sit-in movement that began on February 1, 1960 at Woolworth Department Store in Greensboro, North Carolina. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, emerged from those first sit-ins to help coordinate the sit-in movement. The Congress of Racial Equality, or CORE, helped organize and sponsor both the sit-in movement and the Freedom Rides. CORE was founded in 1941, inspired by Krishnalal Sridharani's 1939 book, War Without Violence, which outlined Gandhi's step-by-step methods for organizing people and mounting a nonviolent campaign. And Gandhi, in turn, was inspired by the writings of Henry David Thoreau. And there you have it, your connected dots, and there's your summer reading list. The point we want to make in today's program is that events don't happen in a vacuum. There's an interconnectedness between people and events that oftentimes is lost in the history books. What we find stunning about today's recording is that it gives us the individual's personal story and breathes life into what history books have as a collective description of the activists from both the sit-in movements and the Freedom Rides. In today's From the Vault, we embrace the historical continuum as we celebrate the 50th anniversary of those Freedom Rides and the courage it took for the individuals to join the campaign. We begin with a 1961 recording of James Farmer right at the beginning of the campaign, one of the co-founders of CORE. He talks about the early nonviolent campaign that would permeate the civil rights movement, led by the Big Six leaders: Dr. Martin Luther King, chairman of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference; John Lewis, first president of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee; Roy Wilkins, executive director of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People; labor leader A. Philip Randolph, executive director of the National Urban League; and the sixth leader, James Farmer. Here is Mr. Farmer.
Mr. Farmer, I believe you are the first national director of CORE. At least I don't remember any previous person with this title. Could you tell me something about your post?
Yes, well, this is the first time that CORE has had a national director. The office was reorganized. You see, within the past year and a half, CORE has undergone a great growth, largely as a result of the student sit-in movement in the South. And because of that growth, it was necessary to consider the organizational problems of the outfit. And as a result, we set up new titles, new divisions of responsibilities. And I was invited to join the staff as national director.
How long has CORE been in existence now?
Well, CORE was founded in 1942 in Chicago, so it's 19 years old.
And how many branches have you now?
We have 50 local chapters scattered throughout the country.
Well, isn't that a pretty rapid growth? It seems to me that it wasn't anywhere nearly that many not too long ago.
Oh, yes. Within the past 2 years, most of CORE's growth has taken place. I would say that when CORE was founded back in 1942, Mrs. Thompson, nonviolence was not very well known, not well respected, and There had been very little experimentation along those lines. However, in 1956, with the Montgomery bus boycott in Alabama under the leadership of Martin Luther King, nonviolence came much more into prominence. And it was then that CORE's great growth began, and that growth was even more accelerated by the Southern Student Sit-In Movement, which began a year ago, February.
I believe you have just been involved in this cross-country bus ride. Now, I'm sorry to admit that I haven't really had time to follow up this story, and you can begin at the beginning and tell me what the purpose was and how many people were involved and so on.
Well, very gladly, Ms. Thompson. CORE's Freedom Ride is now a part of American history, and I think that all persons in the country, all citizens, should be aware of it. You see, back in 1946, the United States Supreme Court, in the Irene Morgan case, ruled that there could be no segregation of interstate passengers on buses. More recently, in 1960, the Supreme Court ruled in the Boynton case that there must be no discrimination or segregation of interstate passengers in any of the facilities at bus terminals. It was therefore following up on these two rulings that CORE decided upon its Freedom Ride, whereby an interracial group from all over the country, at least half of them being from the South, would travel as interstate passengers by regular interstate carriers, Greyhound and Trailways, through the South, including the Deep South, refusing to submit to the local customs of segregation, seeking unsegregated seating on buses, seeking use of all the bus terminal and rest stop facilities en route, including the waiting rooms, the lunch counters, restaurants, washrooms, and so forth.
Well, now tell me, how many of you went, where did it start from, and what sort of thing happened?
Well, we started from Washington, D.C. on May 4th, after 2.5 days of preparation and training for the trip in Washington. In this 2.5 days which preceded the ride, we discussed the purposes and philosophy of the Freedom Ride. I could state that purpose very simply, I think, by stating that we felt that there's a long step between the establishment of good laws or the issuing of Supreme Court rulings on one hand and the enforcement of those laws or those decisions on the other. And so the purpose of the Freedom Ride was to seek enforcement of the anti-segregation laws and rulings of the federal government and to urge people, Negro and white, when they're traveling as interstate passengers, to refuse to submit to local customs of segregation and to seek unsegregated use of all facilities, to encourage Negroes in the various communities through the South to do that, to encourage white people in traveling to do that, and also to turn the spotlight of public opinion throughout America on the issue of segregation in the Deep South, because it was our feeling that as much as we might like to do it, Alabama and Mississippi cannot be swept under the nation's rug. Now, we had 2.5 days of training. We anticipated all the things that might occur. We knew that there would probably be arrests, and we were prepared for arrests if they took place. The members of the Freedom Ride were pledged not to accept bail, but to stay in jail, not to pay fines if fined, but to serve their time, feeling that they could spotlight the issue much better in that way. We knew that there was a great possibility, if not a probability, of violence, and we were prepared for that, too. We left on May 4th, boarding 6 people, boarding Greyhound, and 7 people boarding Trailways for Richmond, Virginia. From Richmond, we went to Petersburg and then Lynchburg, Virginia, and at each rest stop and at each terminal, we sent test groups of the Freedom Riders in to test the use of the facilities.
Yes.
Now, we found that throughout most of Virginia, the signs had been removed, that is, the 4 colored and 4 white signs. In some places, the signs were still up. In still others, they were up, but an attempt had been made to paint them out, that is, one stroke of the brush. The signs were still visible, but they had made an effort to paint them out. We found also that where Negroes insisted upon being unsegregated, insisted upon using the previously for white waiting rooms and facilities. They could do so. But by and large, they were not insisting upon it, but by force of habit or out of fear, were using the previously segregated facilities. A sort of de facto segregation existed there. However, in one rest stop, Danville, Virginia, we found that the Negroes in the group were readily served at the lunch counter in the white waiting room, but white members of the group were refused service by the manager in the Negro waiting room. The manager went over and talked to them and told them that they would have to go into the other side to get service. They asked why. He said it's a local custom. They told him they thought the Supreme Court had cleared all this up. No, indeed, said he, this is a local custom and we won't serve you here. Well, they refused to move. He asked for their names and they asked for his, and he finally had them served. But that was Virginia. And if I may go on, from there we went to North Carolina, Greensboro, North Carolina, and Charlotte. In Charlotte, we had our first arrest. We had not expected any arrests that early in the trip. We had thought we certainly would get to South Carolina, which is the gateway to the Deep South. But in Charlotte, we used all of the facilities, the waiting room, the lunch counters, the restaurant, and the washroom without difficulty. But one Negro Freedom Rider then went into the bus terminal barbershop and sought to get his shoes shined. And there he was refused. He asked to see the manager, and the manager came with five policemen. The young man was arrested. The charge was trespassing. It went to trial 2 days later, and he was acquitted. He was found not guilty on grounds of the Supreme Court decision banning discrimination in bus terminal facilities. Then, Ms. Thompson, we went on to South Carolina. And our first stop in South Carolina was Rock Hill. And at Rock Hill, our Greyhound bus contingent got off the bus at the terminal, and they found a little reception awaiting them on the part of local hoodlums. So a Negro and a white Freedom Rider tried to go into the white waiting room, and one hoodlum who was blocking the door said to the Negro, "The other side." And he replied, "I have a right to go in here," and proceeded to walk. He was then beaten by the hoodlum and one of the hoodlum's cohorts. He was slugged several times. The white Freedom Rider then stepped between the Negro and his attackers and absorbed the punishment himself. And he was attacked, and other hoodlums who were in the waiting room then rushed out joined in the attack. One young white woman Freedom Rider was knocked down in the process. The white man, Freedom Rider, was also knocked down. At this point, but not before, the police intervened. Then from Rock Hill...
Were there any arrests in this case?
Well, the policemen were willing to make an arrest. They asked Albert Bigelow, the white Freedom Rider who had been knocked down, if he would press charges, and he said no, because he did not feel that this was the way to handle it. He was interested in talking with his assailant to see if he could not convince him of the wrongness of his thinking and his ways of action. The hoodlum who had attacked, however, refused to talk to him. And this brings us to an observation which I think is significant. We found it all through the ride, that the white Freedom Riders took more violence than the Negroes. The hoodlums attacked them with greater viciousness. This hoodlum then said to Albert Bigelow, "I would talk to the blacks before I would talk to you. I could kill you," because he was considered a traitor. From Rock Hill, after staying overnight there, we went to Sumter. En route to Sumter, there were two arrests at Winnsboro, South Carolina, at the lunch counter in the white waiting room. One Negro and one white Freedom Rider were arrested. They were held for several hours, no charges, no formal charges, though it was rumored that the Negro was arrested for trespassing and the white arrested for interfering with an officer's performance of his duty. He had merely asked, "Where are you taking my friend? I'm traveling with him." They were released that night, the Negro being released at 11 o'clock after the last bus had left town, and he was taken to the bus terminal and released, and he found a mob waiting for him there. So it was virtually by the skin of his teeth that he was able to get out of that situation. He found a Negro sitting in his car, whom he was able to pay to take him to a telephone. And the Negro took him to a Negro minister's home. He was then driven to Columbia, South Carolina, where he found overnight lodging, and by bus the next morning proceeded to join the rest of the Freedom Riders in Sumter, South Carolina. Sumter, there was no difficulty. We went through Georgia without incident. Augusta, Georgia, and Atlanta. I say without incident, but it ought to be pointed out that there were large crowds of people with hostile faces filled with hate at each stop, waiting for us. But we used the facilities without difficulty. Well, in Atlanta, I unfortunately received word of my father's death. This was Sunday, May 14th, and had to board the first plane I could get to Washington, D.C., where he had died, for the funeral. I was in charge of the project of the Freedom Ride, and I designated another person to take over that responsibility for the rest of the ride. This person was a white member of the group, James Peck, from New York. The Freedom Ride then proceeded from Atlanta to Birmingham, and that, as everyone knows by now, is where they ran into their most serious violence.
This is where the bus was set on fire?
Yes,
or something?
That was at Anniston, Alabama, which is a rest stop between Atlanta, Georgia, and Birmingham. The Greyhound bus had its tires slashed by hoodlums at Anniston, so that when the bus proceeded to leave Anniston, it got a very short distance before it had two flats, could proceed no further. Then the hoodlums were there waiting for it in their cars, and they got out and with clubs and rocks broke the windows of the bus and threw a firebomb inside, which created a great deal of smoke and then burst into flames, and the bus was completely gutted and destroyed. The passengers, including the Freedom Riders, scrambled out through the windows, and a policeman who was standing around merely fired one shot into the air at this point, claiming that was to disperse the mob. This was after the damage had been done. Our contact in Birmingham, a Negro minister, Reverend Shuttlesworth, then dispatched several private automobiles from Birmingham to Anniston to pick up the Freedom Riders. This was, I should say, after they had been treated at the hospital for smoke inhalation and other minor injuries. Well, our second contingent of the Freedom Ride arrived in Anniston an hour or so later. And when the Freedom Riders got off the bus to test the terminal facilities, they found the facilities all locked up. They could not get in. They got back on the bus, and the bus driver then announced that the Greyhound bus which preceded them had been burned to the ground, and said he was not moving his bus until the, quote, niggers, unquote, get back into the back seats where they belong. The Negro Freedom Riders refused to move, and at that point, eight hoodlums, who had previously boarded the bus, got up and went to the front and beat the Negro passengers who were sitting up front. When two white Freedom Riders tried to protest, they too were beaten and were left lying on the floor of the bus in the aisle, and they reported to me by phone after the incident that they saw the Negro Freedom Riders being hurled bodily over them into the rear of the bus by the hoodlums. The bus then went to Birmingham, and what happened there is now an unfortunate page in history. They were met by a mob and were badly beaten. Jim Peck, whom I had left in charge of the Freedom Ride, he's a white man from New York. He was severely beaten, had to have 57 stitches taken in his face and head. Gashes all over his face and head from the beating. They beat him more mercilessly than they had beaten the Negroes. He says that as they had knocked him down and were kicking and slugging him with chains and with brass knucks as well as with bare fists, they were screaming, get him, Jesus, get him good. And he wound up in the hospital, of course, being treated.
What did this terminate the whole situation?
No.
Were there people left who could go on and proceed any further?
Well, the people who were beaten were, of course, hospitalized and treated. But their determination was to leave Birmingham and go as previously scheduled to Montgomery, then to Jackson, Mississippi, and on to New Orleans, arriving there on May 17th, which is, incidentally, the anniversary of the Supreme Court school desegregation decision. Well, the next day, when they went to the bus terminal to board buses, for Montgomery, they sat in the terminal for several hours, waiting for the bus to leave. The bus would not leave because, it was said by the company, no driver would take the bus to Montgomery. They finally, since they couldn't get out and there was a mob of people waiting outside the terminal, they made reservations by plane for New Orleans and succeeded in getting to the airport and flying to New Orleans, bypassing Montgomery and Jackson, Mississippi, out of necessity. And in New Orleans on May 17th, the Freedom Ride culminated in a giant Freedom Rally at Negro Baptist Church, where there were several thousand people and hundreds others in the street who could not get in, applauding the gallantry, the courage of the Freedom Riders.
How many, are any of them still hospitalized, or were the injuries so that they're able to be normal again?
Yes, there are
any of these injuries permanent?
As far as we know, there were no permanent injuries. I've talked with Jim Peck, who was the beaten up worst, and he says he is feeling fine, though he still has bandages and patches all over his face and head. But apparently there are no serious injuries. One young lady in the group, I understand, may have to go to the hospital for further treatment from smoke poisoning. This is as a result of being on the bus when the firebomb was thrown in.
Well, then, were all of these people able, I presume Peck was not, to take the plane into New Orleans?
Yes.
And be there?
Peck did too. As a matter of fact, right after he got out of the hospital, after he had lost so much blood and had been so badly beaten, I talked with him by phone and suggested to him that perhaps he should fly immediately to New Orleans rather than endeavoring to go by bus through Montgomery and Jackson. He said, absolutely not. If the Freedom Ride goes on, I go on with it. And he tried to go on with them. When they finally left by plane for New Orleans, he was on the plane with them.
What has been the press response on this in the South?
Well, in the South, generally we found that the press played it straight, so to speak. There was straight reporting without much editorializing, telling exactly what was happening, how many people there were, where they were from, and what they said they were trying to do. In some cases, however, there was editorializing. In Sumter, South Carolina, the local paper, the day of our scheduled arrival there, had a heading, a headline, saying, "Race Baiters Arrive in Sumter Today." This was an inflammatory headline if I ever saw one. However, the news story under that headline was straight reporting. It had come from an AP or UPI dispatch, and it was straight. But the headline told the story they wanted to tell.
Yes, but since all this violence and the burning of the bus and the beating of the people, has there been any outcry in the Southern press? How has it been treated?
It has merely been reported upon without any editorial comments, as far as I know. There was one editorial in the Charleston daily paper, Charleston, South Carolina, prior to the severe violence in Alabama, which said, in effect, well, the heading of the editorial was Southern Invasion, and it said that here we are being invaded by a mobile band of Negro agents who are skilled and well-disciplined and well-trained. They are concerned about all minorities except one, that one being the Southern white man. This was, in a way, an inflammatory editorial, and we considered it an invitation to violence. But there has not been much play-up of the violence which actually took place in Alabama.
Well, what is your own estimate of the achievement of the effort?
Well, I think that it has pointed up to the American people very clearly the fact of the evil nature and the brutality involved in segregation and bigotry in the deep southern states, especially Alabama and Mississippi. I think it has aroused more determination on the part of Negroes throughout the country to call a halt to segregation as far as their own submission to it is concerned. I expect that large numbers of Negroes who will be traveling this summer by bus will seek use or demand use of all facilities at the bus terminal without segregation. I am sure that this will take place. I think it is pointed up for all of us to see, if we needed to see it, that there are sections of our country in which Americans who believe in equality cannot travel in dignity without risking their life and limb. And I do believe, Mrs. Thompson, that it has increased the determination of large numbers of Americans to do something about it.
What was the attitude of the other passengers on these buses? I mean, they were not chartered buses or anything.
No.
They were just general public buses.
They were regularly scheduled buses.
How did the rest of the passengers behave?
Well, I would say that it varied. Their reactions varied. First of all, let me point out that after they saw us, they immediately identified us as a part of the Freedom Ride. The Freedom Ride had received such advanced publicity throughout the country, and especially in the South, that when they saw us and saw Negroes sitting up front, they knew that they were on the bus with the Freedom Ride. As a result, their response was more cautious than it probably would have been otherwise. We did run into some hostility. We ran into one situation where a white man boarded a bus in Georgia and asked the bus driver if he would order the, quote, niggers, unquote, to move together and sit in the same seats back further so he could sit down. The bus driver refused to do it on the grounds that they are interstate passengers and legally he could not ask them to move. We ran into other incidents where white passengers boarded the bus at roadside stops and they themselves asked Negroes if they would move back so they, the white persons, could sit down there. The Negroes, in every case, Negro Freedom Riders, politely and courteously suggested to the person that you may sit right here, meaning by me. In some cases, they did so. In others, they moved until they found a vacant seat.
What was the response of Negro passengers on the bus? I mean, non-Freedom Riders.
By and large, sympathy and interest and support. Most of them, we found, were a little too frightened to participate actively with us. Though on some occasions we did find that Negro passengers would board the bus, look around, and see the Freedom Riders sitting in the front, and then would take a front seat themselves, and very proudly. We found on other occasions Negro bus passengers who were not Freedom Riders would leave the bus at bus terminals and start into the Negro facilities, look through the window and see that the Freedom Riders had entered the white waiting room and were sitting at the lunch counter and were being served. So they then would enter and sit down and seek service. This is one thing we hoped to accomplish, and I think we did it.
I should imagine that some of the passengers, particularly after the trouble started, that got on the buses, were not being allowed to exercise their own judgment, but were quite honestly perhaps frightened, and as events turned out, with some justification.
Yes, I think they probably were. I think they were frightened.
Don't you feel that there's a good deal of fear in the South on from both directions? Isn't that one of the chief difficulties for the average civilized person of either race?
Yes, it is. Lillian Smith put it well once several years ago. Well, not several years ago, 2 years ago, when she said, in the past, Southern whites have been afraid of Southern Negroes. Now, Southern whites are afraid of Southern whites. And I think that that is the situation. There are liberal voices. There are voices of goodwill in the South, but those voices in the past several years have been stilled out of fear. They have not spoken up. This, I might add, Mrs. Thompson, was another object of the Freedom Ride, to try to instill some guts into the decent white people of the South so that they would make their voices heard in this situation. I think that in some sense we did accomplish that. We noticed that at some of the stops, the bus stops, after word had gotten through the South that we were coming, we would see automobiles standing at the bus terminal with a family in it, a man and a wife, obviously, waiting for the Freedom Riders to arrive. We'd get off the bus and they would stand there and watch until we were safely in our taxis, and then they would drive away. These persons obviously were not hoodlums who were waiting there to beat us up or give us trouble. They were there to watch, and I think that on these occasions, had there been trouble, they probably would have intervened.
And your feeling is that the people by whom you were attacked were a violent minority group, an organized violent minority group?
I think they certainly were. We've had previous experiences in Rock Hill and Sumter, South Carolina, and we know for a fact that many of these people whom we call hoodlums are not acting spontaneously, but are acting with the backing of the White Citizens Council.
Well, I'm very grateful to you for coming into the studio and giving us this firsthand account of the trip that we have heard so much about one way or another through our press. Thank you very much, Mr. Farmer.
Thank you, Mrs. Thompson.
This is the Pacifica Radio Archives series From the Vault, and you are listening to a 1960 recording of James Farmer, one of the co-founders of the Congress of Racial Equality.